Oh, they don't want me to do it.
I have a question for you. Yeah. It's maybe not quite so much of a question because somebody came to me here about how trials and people think are the most dramatic. And I've never really had anything better than that. So I'm kind of like, I'm thinking that maybe I have 2 years and I'll be sure to guess it, but I kind of go back and forth with something like, is it that the word? Is it that to trust me with a trial, or is it that he's testing me by letting everything go well? Or, like, it's just something I thought about. I don't know if you mind me talking about it.
I think there are people that the Lord actually spares. You know, he has all different tactics and processes, but I think there are some people who actually are helpers of others in trouble. They come alongside them, and they don't necessarily, like Barnabas. We don't read of Barnabas going through the things that Paul did. He seemed to be fairly wealthy. Extra real estate to sell and so on. But he was his name, you know, son of consolation, encouragement. He was able to get alongside other people like Paul in his trouble. When Paul basically was kind of off balance, the Lord, the Christians were nervous, they were afraid of him, and so on. He comes in and helps Paul, you know. And then, of course, earlier on, when there's financial need, he's able to step in and help him, and so on. So it seems that there are some people who don't necessarily have burdens of their own, but they're burden bearers of other people. They have a sensitivity, they see needs, they step in. So I don't know that and the scripture said bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. That it's quite possible that there are some people that don't necessarily have the troubles themselves, but are ready to step under the load of someone else and help them along.
So when it says that those who live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted, is that just speaking in general, or
no? I really think that if we were more outspoken and more engaging in our culture, we would bear more reproach.
Yeah.
And we went to Little Rock with the team. The manager of the hotel called me in and said, "I want you to tell all your people not to speak to anyone about Jesus in this hotel." I said, "I'd like to know if in the history of the Holiday Inn, any manager ever told any paying customer what they could or couldn't talk about in the hotel." Four of the cleaning staff were led to the Lord that week. The week after we left, he fired them all. He professed to be a believer. The police were called on us, and when the policeman came down, he said, "You're not doing anything wrong. By the way, what's this you're handing out? This literature." So he took it back, went back to the police station, called up John Heller and said, "This is good stuff. Can you bring one for all the police?" John went down and had a little gospel meeting at the police
station. Security guards at the mall.
What's that?
The security guards at the mall.
Yeah, the security guards at the mall. It was like,
because that distracted for 45 minutes while the other doors get hit.
Yeah, they said, "Sorry, you know, we'd like to let you do it, but, you know, we'd lose our jobs if he lets you do it." And then they said, "You know, could I have one, you know?" And then it dries up again, and I think my mother-in-law liked one, and eventually took one, a bunch for the rest of the staff, and, you know. But some of the communities paid security guards to drive around the neighborhood and say, "You touch, step on any property, we'll have you arrested for trespassing." This is in the Bible Belt. You know, this is the buckle of the Bible Belt. The Merchants Association had us kicked out of the pavilion we'd been promised for the week. The five deans of the university called our people in and said, "You intimidate us. From now on, you can't walk beside anyone to talk to them. You can't stand in front of anyone to talk to them. You can't hand out free water bottles. You can't preach in the open air." Like, they had no right to say anything. The Parks Commission called up
to Bobby Heller and said, we found out that you're meeting in the pavilion, and we're going to have to charge you back rent for using the pavilion. We were in the worst slums of the city. And Bobby Heller said, you know who uses those pavilions? Drug dealers and pimps and prostitutes. We thought those kids were worth better than that. You charge them back rent? And by the end of the conversation, she said, look, we're Christians and we'll do what's right. If you want to charge us, we'll pay it. By the end of the conversation, she said, you know, you ought to be in all our parts. The school board had promised that we could use the school for the kids' club during the day, and then they reneged on it. When it hit the newspaper, superintendent got inundated with phone calls, so he pulled that. They allowed us to have the evening meetings, but they sent the custodian in every night to spy on us and report back to them what we were doing. 2 weeks later, I was back in town, took him out for lunch, and told me he'd got saved at those meetings. But that's how we found out that he was spying on us, had been sent in to spy on us. They were talking about us, the governor, Huckabee, the guy who's now running for the president, Huckabee's office sent us someone to meet with us and say, is there anything we can do to help? The mayor's office wrote an injunction against John and Bobby Heller that they couldn't hold a Bible study in their home.
How could he do that?
Well, you tell me. I don't know. I called him up and I said, is this what you do for people having Tupperware parties? Huh? They said, well, you know, sir, it's a parking issue. I said, well, have people park in the park. We'll drive them up in our bus. No. If we're driving by, we're checking. If we see a Bible study going on, we're going to arrest them.
What?
So, of course, we had several of these Christian legal beagles call us up and say, well, we'll go to court for you and so on. And John Bobby said, well, we're here to preach the gospel. We're not here to fight, you know, lawsuits. But it was just another reminder that if you get out there, you know, they tried to stop us at every juncture. But in the end, it always turned out for good. Like, it was so funny. Like, they kicked us out of the room we had rented in the hotel. We were having our meetings. So we moved out into the pool area. Well, of course, our singing wafted into all the rooms. So pretty soon they send this woman down to stop us, you know. It's just, and when I talk, like, there was one gal who had started these Bible studies with these Spanish cleaning ladies, and he said, you can't do that anymore. And so she was going into their lunchroom. They invited her into the lunchroom to have a Bible study at noon. So I said, well, that's fine. They can go to her room. And he said, no, they can't do that. We can't have the guests mingling with the staff. So I said, okay, well, I'll rent a room. No, I won't rent one today. I said, all right. They'll just go out and sit in the grass. No, he said, they have to check out and leave the property. It was just, you know, and yet when we go to some of the doors, people would come out of their doors and they'd hug our people and say, you know what, we're Christians, we ought to be doing this. We tried it once and they shut us down and we just stopped. We gave up. So I think if we actually got back, you know, like in Sioux Falls, the cops came every day on the guys who were preaching the opener. One day they came down and they said, John Mark Biorley was preaching, said, well, I think you ought to just move on. And John Mark said, well, if we had to, we would, but we don't have to, so we won't. So the next day they came down and said, we have an ordinance that if there are more than 10 people in the city, it's a demonstration. But 10 people in the city, then it's a demonstration, and you get a special permit for this. See, we'd gone and got open air preaching permits, told them exactly what corner we'd be on, the whole thing. See?
Yeah.
So, and then, so that didn't work. So then the next day they came down again. Like they would have an unmarked police car pull in, and they had somebody sitting there with a clipboard, you know. So I come up and I say, listen carefully, get all the points here now, you know. And so then they say, we have an ordinance that if a drunk man is shouting in a residential area at night, we can arrest him for disturbing the peace. We're going to use that against you. So I said to the policeman, you realize how encouraging it would be if some of our people got arrested. Do you know what it would do for the prayer? We have 1,000 people around the world who get a daily printout about what's happening in Sioux Falls. Can you imagine how encouraged they'd be if they found out that some of our people have been arrested? It would just revolutionize their prayer meetings.
Wow.
Yeah.
But we're not worried about this. And they said, well, one more complaint and he's arrested. Well, anyway, I think that's true, that if we actually started getting out there. See, in the early days of the church, and in the life of the Lord Jesus, the common people heard them gladly because they considered that they were authentic. They were real. They had something different to say, right?
Yeah.
The authorities thought they were a threat. A threat to their system. A threat to their power base. In our society, the authorities don't think we're a threat. And the common people don't hear us gladly because they don't think we're authentic. Mm-hmm. Here's what George Barna says. This is called the Second Coming of the Church. Americans today are more devoted to seeking spiritual enlightenment than at any previous time during the 20th century. Yet at this moment of optimum opportunity, Christianity is having less impact on people's perspectives and behaviors than ever. Why is that? Because a growing majority of people have dismissed the Christian faith as weak, outdated, and irrelevant. Interestingly, the stumbling block for the church is not its theology, but its failure to apply what it believes in compelling ways. The downfall of the church has not been the content of its message, but its failure to practice those truths. Christians have been their own worst enemies when it comes to showing the world what authentic biblical Christianity looks like and why it represents a viable alternative to materialism, existentialism, mysticism, and the other doctrines of popular culture. Those who have turned to Christianity and churches seeking truth and meaning have left empty-handed, confused by the apparent inability of Christians themselves to implement the principles they profess. So my question is, how radical do we want to be? Now, the so-called early brethren, I mean, the early Christians were, right? I mean, for Jews and Gentiles meeting together, this was totally radical. For rich and poor, slaves treating their masters and masters treating their slaves like brothers and sisters, and just blew their socks off, you know? And then this concept of taking your money and your real estate, selling it, and giving your money to others, and that was just, it would be unheard of today, wouldn't it? Well, that's the question. How radical? We fit in so well. We, you know, nobody can tell the difference. So the issue is not wearing funny clothes. You know, it's not growing beards and wearing, you know, not having buttons on our shirts or something. That's not going to make the difference. There has to be something so radical that the whole world stands up and says, this is really different. You know, like our hope is so much like their hope. Want to get a career, make money, have a nice house in suburbia, get an SUV. You know, like, what's the diff, right? So, when you think about what would really shock society, suppose there were 50 Christians who said, we have abandoned the inner city. We're going to move into the inner city. We're going to buy an old warehouse. We're going to fix it up as apartments, and we're going to live there. And we're going to go out every day, reach into the community. We're going to help the old ladies, the grandmothers that are raising these little black kids, their grandchildren, and set up a little health clinic for people, a free clinic, and we're going to help unwed mothers. We're going to have some dorms for unwed mothers here. If people are thinking about abortion, they can move in here or whatever. All right, so this kind of stuff. We're going to take the city by storm and live Christianity in the city. I had a dream one night. I hardly ever remember my dreams if I have them. But I had a dream one night that I was living on a little island off the coast of Labrador, because I had heard that the highest suicide rate was among these native kids that were living on this island. And I thought, if I move there and if God can change those kids, it'd be like Saul of Tarsus getting saved. If the worst place was revolutionized, then everybody would know that God was able to fix their problem too. And I woke up. See? So then I began to think about this. You know, actually, we have people in the toughest places. We already have them there. I mean, we've got people in Brooklyn, the inner city of Brooklyn. The Iwana Club had to stay overnight one night because there were two guys gunned down outside who had live ammo on them, and the bomb squad wouldn't come in until the morning to disarm them. So they keep 180 kids in the chapel all night long. It was a war zone, right?
Yeah.
The assemblies in downtown Detroit. It's a war zone where they live. But they're making a difference. Now, what they did was they got an old bar, turned it into a gym. They got basketball hoops, and they actually got a boxing ring. And the kids can come there on the condition they're there at 4 o'clock to hear the gospel. And when they come in, there's supper there, because these kids never get a hot meal. There's supper waiting for them, and soft drinks and so on, and sports and everything else, and they give them the gospel every day. The Ford Motor Company, the Ford Foundation, came in and they said, "You are the only people making a real difference in the lives of kids." And they give them enough money to build a first-class gym downtown Detroit. Because they're making a difference. Well, this is what George Mueller did. I mean, George Mueller, I'm sure, had a care for orphans. But he had a much bigger plan than orphans. Mm-hmm. He was saying, England doesn't believe there's a God. Well, that's what we have in America. All kinds of people don't believe there's a God. Because we don't give them any reason to believe it. If we, like the George Mueller thing, what would be a 21st century George Mueller project? Okay, suppose, here's just an example. Okay, George Mueller was given the equivalent of $25 million in today's money. Where did he get that money? I'll tell you where he got it. Assemblies held auctions. And they brought all their silverware and all their tapestries and all their paintings. One assembly took them 2 days to auction off all their stuff. People downsized, sold their big houses and downsized to smaller houses. Robert Cleaver Chapman, the first time he came into Barnstable, rode in with a coach and four, you know, livery men and four matching horses. The next time he walked in, one of his old friends saw him getting on the train in London, third class. He said, "What are you doing riding third class?" He said, "There's no fourth class." But these people were landed gentry. The guys like John Nelson Darby, he slept in the barns when he was working in Wicklow, County Wicklow, among the Catholics. He saw, they said, sometimes as many as 500 Roman Catholics saved a year. When nobody was seeing any Roman Catholics saved. Because he slept in their barns. I mean, he was born in Leek Castle. His middle name, Nelson, is after Lord Nelson because his uncle was one of the commanders of Nelson's ships. These people were at the top of the heap. And Darby, for 26 years, didn't unpack a suitcase. Wandering the hills of Switzerland and France, preaching the gospel. They said in Switzerland and France, he was seeing, on average, 100 people a week saved. People don't even know that. They just think he was some dusty old theologian writing, right, you know, books that nobody reads. So, if I were to say, all right, here's $25 million, I say, "Lord, we're gonna ask for a double portion. Could you give us $50 million? What we'd like to do is establish some centers across the U.S. for families with special needs kids. Autistic, Down syndrome, Fragile X syndrome, whatever. And we'll have research hospital, we'll have like a resort thing where they can come, they can relax, we'll look after their kids, they can get some refreshment, they can have some marriage counseling because it's a huge strain on their marriages. They'll have activities for their siblings who never get looked after because they put all their energies into their special needs kids. We'll have big kitchens where we can teach them how to cook for their kids. We'll have counseling for them. You know, well, that would be the equivalent of what George Mueller did in England, where these orphans were running loose on the streets, and he took them in. And he set an example. It wasn't just George Mueller. I mean, there was Dr. Bernardo, who was inspired by Mueller. There was W.C. Fegan, who started a boys' home, who, by the way, preached the gospel to Charles Darwin. Darwin's sister got saved. Darwin's butler got saved at those meetings. It's in Chief Men Among the Brethren. It's a tremendous story about how the gospel was preached there on the Darwin estate. But anyway... it seems to me that this is something. All these families, what are they saying? One out of 150 kids born into the U.S. now are autistic. One out of every 150. And some of these families have multiple autism, in their family. So if there was something like that, where we poured out the love of God on these people, provided environment, didn't take any government funds, preach the gospel, let everybody know this is Christian, this is what Christians do. That's just one example, one sample. I'm sure there are lots of other things that could be done,
Mm-hmm.
But,
that would be... The challenge would be to make sure that from one generation to the next, the focus stays on the gospel.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it could.
Some people say that, believers should never take money from unbelievers for things like this. How do you feel about that? I don't really understand.
Well, there are two verses, aren't there? The one verse says, taking nothing of the Gentiles. All right, that's 3 John, is it? Where the Lord's... See, the disciples, when they were sent out by twos, the 70 were sent out, the Lord said, don't take a bag, don't take a purse. Because it was the obligation of Israel to look after their holy men, to look after their prophets and their priests. And so Jesus was claiming authority here. And he was saying, you are men of God, and they ought to look after you. So he sent them out, and he said, if you come to a town and they don't look after you, wipe the dust off your feet and go somewhere else. So Jesus was laying claim to authority to send forth his servants and expect Israel to look after them. But when the disciples were sent out to the world in the second commission, now he said, you better get a sword, for that was protection, of course, against snakes and wild animals and so on, and you better have a purse. And so now they were going out to the Gentiles. And so now the word is, the Christians need to look after these people. And we should not take from the Gentiles. And the word take there is, that's the emphasis, that we shouldn't expect them to pay, and we shouldn't be extorting, we shouldn't be claiming money from the Gentiles. That's the idea there. But then when Paul is shipwrecked on Malta, it says the barbarian showed us no little kindness. These were unbelievers. And he accepted the hospitality of these unbelievers. So I think as long as we make clear that you understand this is not meritorious, this isn't a matter of you earning your way to heaven, right?
Yeah, right.
Would you make a distinction between the hospitality and financing something?
Well, I think in many places where this happens, where people feel they want to give something, the Christians would have like an alms box, so to speak, where money for the poor, they wouldn't use it specifically for the Lord's work in evangelism. We don't want to be in a situation where people finance their own evangelism. But if you had something where we say, well, we have a fund for the poor in the community, and we'll receive this, and if that's fine with you, we'll put it into that fund. That's appropriate. Because
that's like, you mean the place in Detroit where they for like a humanitarian sort of thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so the difference between that and funds used for evangelism is
Yeah, a part of the big issue is, like, for example, not taking any government funds. Whoever pays the piper calls the tune.
Yeah.
And rarely are you in a situation where, like, if you get a free grant, that's a different thing than getting, you know, like, from a foundation where there are no strings attached, you take it and use it. But if you end up in a situation where if they're sending you a monthly stipend, then they come in, they set standards, and they determine what you can and can't do. And you don't want to be in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Does the story of Abraham and how he wouldn't take anything from Solomon, does that have anything to do with this?
It may. It's interesting to see. That was his personal conviction. He didn't impose his conviction on anybody else. He said, now, Ener and Eshcol here, let them take whatever they want. So it wasn't that he thought it was absolutely a wrong thing.
Mm.
But that he personally wanted God to get the glory for his success, not the king of Sodom, right? That was his concern. The king of Sodom might be able to say, I made Abraham rich. Mm-hmm. And I think that largely, George Mueller's desire, you can't stop. If an anonymous gift came in from an unbeliever, how would you ever know? What could you do about it? But his purpose was more than just looking after the orphans. He wanted to convince England that there was a God in heaven that supernaturally looked after things. There was no way to explain George Mueller's orphanages except there was a God in heaven who supernaturally provided.
Yeah.
So you would want that situation. You wouldn't just want, take some money and there it is, it's all done. You'd want the Lord to work in such an obvious way.
Yeah, because I'm thinking of, I believe it was D.L. Moody. Was it D.L. Moody or... Yes, I believe it was D.L. Moody would never accept money from unbelievers because he felt they would use it as sort of a justification, like a good works that they were doing.
Right.
But I don't know, maybe that was just a personal conviction.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's something actually in Scripture.
No, I know there are people who take that position. Like, there's a book called Pioneer Work in Canada, J.J. Rouse, and he was preaching in the open air, and a man offered him some money, and he refused it, and the man said, if you won't take it, I'm going to go over to the bar there and serve drinks to everybody. And, well, you'll give an account for that. You know, do what you're going to do with it. But, But I think we need to be careful that we're not putting the worst light on something that a person is doing.
No.
Not assuming the worst. There are people who, look, I appreciate what you've done. I want you to know that I appreciate it. And they're not trying to buy their way to heaven or anything like that. So I think I made that distinction, maybe not here, but we often quote that verse, all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags. Well, that's a specific case. These are people who were acting like the devil Friday night and then showing up Saturday to the synagogue and with great aplomb throwing money into the bucket as if everybody would think they're good guys, you know. Whereas the case of Cornelius, thine alms and thy prayers have come up before me as a memorial. So obviously we shouldn't, in our preaching of the gospel, we shouldn't communicate to people we think that good works are a bad thing. Good works are a good thing. God likes good works. But good works aren't meritorious. You can't trade them for heaven. But we shouldn't give people the impression that we're against good works.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. I think we need, I wonder how long we are going to settle for mediocrity, for just eking out a spiritual existence here in America. And like the time is now when we ought to be making the greatest impact for the Lord. And when I look back and I see, for example, when W.P. Nicholson used to preach, he would go to the factory where the people were coming out of the factories, coming and going, the shift changed, and he would preach the gospel to them, you know. And thousands of people got saved. And so the ladies would come and they'd serve tea and the tea to these workmen who were getting out of work. And then they would march like four abreast through the streets of Belfast singing hymns on the way down to this big portable building that had been built. I can't imagine how big it was, but thousands of people would go in there and preach the gospel. Or D.L. Moody, when he would preach, the Chicago newspaper would put the full text of his sermon on the front page of the paper. Well, they were making an impact. You know, and I remember when, like, Franklin Graham with his Samaritan's Purse, when the tsunami hit, they interviewed him, right? First thing. Well, they interviewed him because he happened to be leaving to go there with all these supplies. I mean, millions of dollars worth of stuff that he took over there. And he used the opportunity for the gospel. Franklin never misses the gospel. And so Combs says to him, how can you believe in a loving God when these little babies were ripped out of their mother's arms? And Franklin said, well, I don't understand a lot of things about God, but I do know one thing. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. And Combs didn't get it, and he walked right into it again. And Franklin said, look, those people, they went out to lie on the beach and work on their tan, and the last thing they had in their mind was that that was the day they were going to stand in their sinful souls before a holy God. And he said, one of these days it's going to happen to you. You're going to die and you're going to stand before God. And the question is, are you ready? Like national television. Well, the only reason he gets that opportunity is because he's doing good works. Mm-hmm. Right? He didn't have any other preachers on there. So I really, you know, when you read the New Testament and all the references to good works, you can't believe how many there are. When was the last time we heard a message preached in any of our local churches on good works? You should be careful to maintain good works. In fact, he links fruitfulness with doing good works. Those who are rich should be rich in good works. There are all kinds of, there are whole scads of verses on it. So, it's something we never hear. It's something like, it doesn't exist, but I think we need to get back. I know, you know, there's balance, and I know that there are concerns that, you know, we'll just waste all our time and energy doing good works and never get to the gospel. Well, no, you want balance. You want the good works. You want the good news. You want them together. But I think that we need, again, to get the message out to our communities that we care about people. We don't just care about doing church, and because the assumption people have is the message they hear from most churches, and that message is we want to build our church. We think our church is great. You come to our church. Our church does this. Our church does that. That's what it's all about, right? When we were in this the Good News bus in the parade, I took one of our gospel CDs over to another fellow who was in another church, and they were in the parade as well. Oh, let me get one of yours. It promotes our church, he said. I said, well, no, that's not what this does. This talks about the Lord Jesus, right? So when people think about evangelicals, we're not talking about the liberals. When they think about evangelicals, they think these are people who are empire builders. They're building mega churches. They want me to come to their church. They want my money. That's what they want. When we had this concert, this free concert in Tuscaloosa, there were two guys that drove all the way from Birmingham over to Tuscaloosa, and they said when they came out, we still didn't believe it was free. They couldn't believe that it was free. I mean, like free. Huh? Oh yeah, free, but then you take a love offering, right? But I really think it would be good if serious-minded young people would have a session where they get together, have a bunch of whiteboards, and say, ideas. Let's have some ideas.
Yeah.
You know? And let any ideas go. Look, let's not start working through them yet. But let's just get lots of ideas and ask, how can we impact our culture? Just as a fellow who's an elder in one of the assemblies in Delhi, he's a big advertising business. He said, I want to break through the barrier of Indian national television. Christianity is invisible. Nobody ever, you can't get near Indian national television with anything Christian. But he took that as a challenge. How am I going to do that? So he did a little research. He went around with his video camera, took these beautiful shots all around India, used it as a backdrop for a series, a three-part series he called Gandhi's favorite hymns. Gandhi had mentioned three different hymns that he liked. One of them was Amazing Grace and something. So three different hymns. So he puts these hymns on, and then he explains the meaning of the hymns, which is essentially preaching the gospel. He got 3.5 hours on Indian national television. 700 million viewers. Free. Now we say in America, it's impossible to get in the newspaper. It's impossible to get on national television. Really? You know, what way could we get on television? What way could we get the gospel out? Now there's a fellow up at Greenwood Hills, and he's been, before he got saved, he's only been saved for 4 years. He was into Hinduism and all kinds of stuff. But he's got a PR firm, you know, and so he's asking this question. He said, you know what's really news in America that never gets in the newspaper? People getting saved. So I'm not talking about your bus going around the country. They can put that if they want. I'm talking about people getting saved. What if somebody really got saved? I mean, a person of impact, a person of influence. What if they got saved? Could you write it up and get it in the newspaper? It's worth a try, isn't it? But to try and think about that, when people say it's impossible, you can't do that. Well, you know, I think God could do it, couldn't he? to try and think, what would shake America? What if this guy, the porno king, got saved? What if we made a list of the top 10 bad guys in America, and we started praying for them every day to see God save them, get God to surround them with Christians? I don't know. All I'm saying is America needs to be shaken up. And what's going to do it? Well, I would think that, you know, if Ted Turner got saved, or Saddam Hussein sitting in prison, what if he came out with a statement saying that he had found the true God, found out that Jesus was the Savior? I mean, God saved Nebuchadnezzar, God saved Manasseh, God saved Saul of Tarsus. Why couldn't he save these people? I'm just asking people to think God-sized, not to be so picky, not, you know, so small, and think little things. Little things are not going to shake America. So when Paul rolled into Athens and went and preached at Mars Hill, he was storming the ramparts of the enemy, wasn't he? And God's plan to send Paul on a mission right into Caesar's household, right into the palace. That was Big Bang. That was bringing out the big artillery, wasn't it? So I'm all for every little thing that's done, and I think a million little things make a huge difference. I think we're all for that. We're not just saying we despise little things. Little things can be really influential and do a lot of good. Mm-hmm. But when I look at people like George Mueller, I look at people like David Livingston taking on the slave trade, or John Newton, or whatever it was, you know. And see, there are people like Graham Stain's widow, Gladys. And when this thing happens, money pours in. So what does she do? Well, I'm going to build a hospital for AIDS patients and lepers. I'm going to set up this hospital right in the heart of Orissa, where my husband was murdered. The Christians in India say this is the best thing that ever happened. But Gladys Staines came on national television in India and forgave her Hindu, the murderers of her husband and sons, you know. It shows what Hinduism is, shows what Christianity is. Hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can see the day soon when some of us are going to be arrested for preaching. I see that coming. Mm-hmm. I saw a news clip with a bunch of homosexuals in San Francisco shouting into the TV, "Bring back the lions." Well, they were thinking of feeding the lions with you, you know. That was their point.
Well, I guess that's one way you
got
the news.
Yeah. But some of these books, like George Barna, like, I don't like his answers, but I do like his questions. And like, he, just for example here, he talks about illiteracy in America. This is affecting, if people can't read Bibles, they can't read the gospel tracts we give them, it's going to affect our evangelism. It's going to affect our churches, isn't it? A U.S. Department of Education study concluded that 54% of American adults are either functionally or marginally literate. 60% of United States prison inmates are illiterate. 85% of juvenile offenders, serious reading problems. A recent study of the United Nations showed the U.S. ranked 49th in literacy among 158 nations. Almost half of all adults do not read even one book during a typical year.
Yeah, I believe that.
More than 35 million people in America do not speak English. More than 1 million of last year's high school graduates received their diploma even though they could not read and write at an 8th grade level. And then he adds, the most widely used version of the Bible in the U.S. is the King James Version.
Yeah.
But he has a whole series of issues like this, like poverty, the issue of poverty in America, increasing, you know, the distance between the wealthy and the poor. So I really think it's important for us to begin to think about the country we live in here. I think every Christian family should teach their kids how to speak Spanish, how to speak Chinese, how to, you know. I mean, if we're going to be serious, that they say here that, I forget the date now, when America will no longer be even half Caucasian. It says, at the risk of sounding like an alarmist, I believe the church in America has no more than 5 years to turn itself around and begin to affect the culture. There we are here. Okay. America's population continues to grow at a significant pace, netting roughly 3 million people per year. Today, Caucasians in the U.S. are at zero population growth. Only our minority populations, however, are growing. Based on current projections during the 1990s, the African American segment will have grown by 15%, Hispanic population by 39%, and the Asian community jumped by 40%. The Census Bureau informs us that while 3 out of 4 Americans are presently Caucasian, by 2050 only half the nation will be Caucasian. So you go to one of our workers' conferences, man, it's hard. It's so pale, you know. I mean, we have not done a good job of breaking in. He says this. Sunday morning is the most racially segregated time of the week. So, you know, the early church, they obviously considered these issues. They considered 70% of the population of the Roman Empire were slaves. And they obviously reached into that slave community. They saw lots of slaves saved, right? They reached into the priests. Lots of the priests got saved. The marketplace. They were in the marketplace, and they on the university campuses and so on. They had diversity in their vision, and they went into all these different areas with the gospel. So I really think it would be good to have, I don't mean conferences necessarily, but have times when we get together and just talk about, you know, how can we do this? What are some good ideas?
This is giving
up a lot
to think about.
Yeah. There's a guy out in Gospel Hall in Portageville Prairie, Manitoba. The guy always has his hooks baited. And he's the guy that led Pierre Trudeau's son to the Lord. He's the former Prime Minister of Britain, of Canada. But he's always thinking about ways to get out the gospel. Like, he reads the newspaper. And there was a Canadian guy who was on death row in Texas for murder. He had been using false identity papers, and so the U.S. government didn't know he was a Canadian. Now, there's reciprocity. If there's a Canadian condemned to death in the U.S., before his trial, the Canadian government is told so that they can provide a defense to help their Canadian citizen, you see, and vice versa. Well, they weren't informed, so this was a big hubbub, you see, and everybody's talking about this, and they want to talk about, you know, what about the situation? Well, instead of that, this guy sits down and he writes a letter to the fellow, and he gives him the gospel. The fellow writes back. He writes back. Five or six letters ensue. Eventually, the fellow writes back, tells him how he got saved. He's been saved. Yeah, he was executed, but before he was executed, and nobody hardly knows about this, you know. Well, the story of Michel Trudeau. I don't know if you know this story, but he was traveling out west in his pickup truck with his dog. He was going snowboarding out in British Columbia. He gets to Portage-la Prairie, Manitoba. His truck goes off the road and rolls. His dog runs away. And so he has his truck towed in to get some work done. And he's being checked out at the hospital. And this brother hears about it. I think he maybe works in the pharmacy or something. He hears about it. So he goes in, and Michel Trudeau's fine. He gives him the keys to his car. Well, the guy just rolled his own truck, right? He gives him the keys to his car and says, "You want to go around looking for your dog? Here, take my keys. We're having supper at 5 o'clock. At the clock, if you'd like to come by, here's a map to our house." So 5 o'clock, Michel Trudeau pulls up at the house. So they have supper. He didn't find his dog. They have supper. And the brother says, "Now we got some tent meetings going on." Now, this isn't a church service. This is just in a tent. We go in. We hear some good news about Jesus. Would you like to come? No pressure. So Michel Trudeau, what are you going to say, right? He's given me my car. He's given me my supper. Of course he's going to come. So he comes to the tent meeting. And Gaius Goff is preaching the gospel. And afterwards, they walk out of the tent. And Michel Trudeau by the way, at the beginning of the tent meeting, this brother gets up and says, "There's a young man here, he's lost his dog. I wonder if he will take a moment to pray and ask God to bring the dog back." And Michel Trudeau is thinking, they would never do that at the Catholic Church, right? I'm amazed they did it there. But anyway, they did. So afterwards, he's coming out of the tent, he turns to this brother and he says, "You know, I mean, I finally get it. Like, my church didn't help me to God. It got in the way. Like, it's all done, isn't it? There's nothing we have to do. It's all done." So anyway, they have a conversation into the evening. And so Trio gives him his address and says, "If my dog shows up, you know, could you look after him until I come back through?" So the next morning, he takes his truck. He drives out to the Trans-Canada Highway. Just ready to turn onto the highway, here's his dog sitting by the side of the road. So he stops at the first truck stop, calls up this brother, says, "Please thank the Christians, the dog was waiting for me at the Trans-Canada." He goes out to BC, goes snowboarding with his friends, an avalanche, he's swept into a lake and drowns. At his funeral, his father says, the Prime Minister says, "My son and I were both seeking for the same things. I believe he found what he was looking for. He called me after he visited a little town out of Manitoba and told me he had found peace in this little town in Manitoba." So, a friend of ours in the assembly where Chris is, who had done business with Pierre Trudeau's law firm, we published the story from the point of view of this brother who tells what happened behind the scenes. And so this brother in Chris's assembly cuts out the article from Uplook and sends it to Pierre Trudeau and gets a letter back. acknowledging this gift. See? Well, again, this is the sort of thing. Keeping your eyes open, seeing opportunities, and moving on them. You see, 2 weeks before Princess Diana was killed in a tunnel in Paris, this brother got a deep burden in his heart for her. He was fooling around with Dodi al-Fayed in the Mediterranean, and he thought, what a terrible shame that this woman of stature, of influence, would join Islam in order to marry this guy. So he sits down, he writes a letter to her, and he says, I'm sending you a copy of a statement out of the Bible. Your son is not only going to be the king, he's soon to be the head of the Church of England. And as such, he needs to know the essential message of the Bible. Thankfully, that message is found in one sentence in the Bible, and I'm sending you a copy of that. It was John 3:16. It was a seed sower text. And I'm sending one for his brother. And so he writes this little letter. He sends it off to Diana. He gets a personal handwritten letter back from Diana. Many people have contacted me about my sons. You're the first one who has ever shown an interest in their spiritual needs. So for several hours, she was conscious, lying in the back of that limousine, bleeding to death. John 3:16, the Lord had made sure that it was on her mind before she died. I don't know what happened in that tunnel. But I do know that a brother who was faithful to respond to the leading of the Spirit of God had probably given her God's final chance.
Right. If you say I'm not